Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. If you were listening in to the spot just before the start of our show, there was another show on PRN talking about the law of attraction and how in this sort of New Age idea that we create our own reality, which of course in some very basic non-New Age, hard science brain-informed view is also something the case, although you have to of course spend some time with who the we is that is creating that reality. Is it just the self that we think we are? Is it the programming inside of our minds that we have received? Is we really more of a collective we, as in the human beings around us and the cultures around us help create our individual reality by programming our brains and language centers to organize things as we may, as they appear to be naturally and immediately? So, of course, these questions are very interesting, but I just like to underscore the weird way that far-out spiritual ideas and very in-our-face technological realities are overlapping and resonating in all sorts of peculiar and marvelous ways. And we'll be talking about that today's show. We have with us Cara Platone, who's a award-winning journalist and a teacher at UC Berkeley's Journalism School, and she's going to be talking about her new book, We Have the Technology, How Biohackers, Foodies, Physicians, and Scientists Are Transforming Human Perception One Sense at a Time. And it's a terrific overview of the world of sensory science and our first baby steps into augmented reality and biohacking, really looking at the different ways that mostly scientists and psychologists, neuroscientists are exploring and attempting to enhance or intensify or broaden our sensations and perceptions of the world. So it's kind of like phenomenology hacking. And I was very pleased to read this because while I am no neo-Luddite, I'm very resistant to many of these things and definitely have some of the old school kind of gag reactions to the glee and alacrity with which some people jump into the cyborg future. But something was made very clear to me. When I just finished the book this morning, and at the end we meet up with some biohackers that that Cara introduces us to at the beginning of the book. And these are folks who are, you know, working out, you know, without a net, outside of any regulation or you know, legal clarity. Of course, it's their own bodies, so what are you going to say? Basically, psychonauts, except psychonauts with a good bio grounding. And they were discussing how the first step in any kind of budding biohackers evolution is to get some magnets implanted. And this really does give us a kind of sixth sense, though it really looks more like a kind of extension of touch, but really the ability to suddenly feel magnetic fields around you. And I was thinking about that, yeah, the law of attraction, there's some attraction that I could really enjoy. And I was completely overwhelmed with this desire to have magnets in my fingertips so that I could be sensing electromagnetic waves and magnets and other objects. And it just seemed like totally cool. And I realized, and this we'll come back to later in the show, that a lot of my resistance is really not about body modification or biohacking or fitness tracking as some kind of way of organizing your own body's metrics. It's really about surveillance, and it's really about the way in which these systems enter into society, change balances of power in all sorts of unpredictable ways, and particularly handing over our phenomenology to a network, I think is something that we should all think about really carefully before individually participating in that, if we have any choice. So it was actually really good for me to remind myself that I'm not actually a neo-Luddite, I'm just a little paranoid. And with that, we'll get on. Cara, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hey Eric, how's it going?
It's going really well. No, it was quite a gas reading through your book, because I'm just fascinated with the question of perception and phenomenology, and how we can change it, how we are already influenced by all of these sort of hacks, or soft hacking, as you talk about it. So it was really interesting to cover all this stuff in a handy dandy volume. I thought maybe one place to start out is with an idea that you put forward early in the book that I think really helps contextualize the science and technology that you look at, which is this difference between what you call soft and hard biohacking. I think that's a cool way of kind of setting things up.
Yeah, sure. Well, just to tell your listeners a little bit about who I am. So I'm a science reporter. I'm not a scientist or a psychologist. So I went into this with a huge learning curve. I interviewed more than 100 people for this story, people from all different disciplines. So, not only neuroscience and cognitive psychology, psychology, biochemistry, but also mechanical engineering, perfumery, people who work in the cosmetics industry, in the food industry, people who work with robots, haptics, all kinds of things. Because I wanted to understand all of these different fields that are feeding into this idea of hacking sensory perception or changing sensory perception, whether that's for a medical purpose, to help people who have some kind of need, or to enhance or augment or change what's happening in your mind. And so I went in, maybe not exactly as a clean slate, but with a lot to learn. And over time, I kind of developed this creeping feeling that, hey, a lot of this stuff is very novel. Some of the technologies are pretty obvious that you're wearing them. They light up. They look like a computer. They obviously, they have wires. They're pretty cyborg looking. But the idea of changing what happens in your head, that's really old. And a lot of the people that I talked with said, look, this goes all the way back to the idea of storytelling, the idea of transforming your consciousness with the word. Or people said, what about psychedelic drugs? People have always experimented with that as a way of changing what happens in your head. And I thought, yeah, in a way it's different now, but we're continuing kind of this human field of endeavor, which is sort of manipulating the story of your life that happens in your mind. If you can think of perception, if you can kind of think of it as being sort of the movie that plays in your head, starring and directed by and edited by you, that's what perception is, right? It's the idea that you take in all of this information from the world around you and you cut it and you splice it and you pay attention to certain segments of it, and that's what informs your experience, what you actually consciously sense about the world around you. So I came up with these phrases, the idea of soft biohacking and hard biohacking. Hard biohacking, I mean these guys you kind of referred to before, who are literally putting technology in their bodies in a bid to change their sensory perception. And by soft, I meant all of the ways that we direct attention that are not technological but social. So, for example, your language affects what you think about. It affects the words you have for things, the way you communicate with others. It trains you in the way you perceive things and the way you think about things. Same thing with your culture. Your culture does that too. It tells you what's important, what to pay attention to. And so does your past experience. As we live our lives, we kind of build up this body of experiences, and each one informs our future self about what to do if we encounter a similar situation the next time, right? Pay attention to this, don't pay attention to that. This is important, this is dangerous, this is good to eat, right? So there are all of these mechanisms kind of layered on top of us in the world that inform what we think. They inform our experiences of the world. And some of them we think of as being very foreign and external because it's a technology you put on the body. And some of them we don't even notice at all.
Yeah, and of course, there's the ones in the middle. The one thing that I would kind of add to the way you set up this difference between soft and hard biohacking, which I think is really informative, is that there's, of course, also these very, and you mentioned psychedelic drugs, but probably even more to the point are all these sort of systems of whatever you want, if you want to call it altered states generation or spiritual practice or consciousness training techniques, but also moral training techniques. The idea, meaning that in a way, the influence of our culture and the influence of our language in a way is very passive. Like from our perspectives, we show up, we realize we're born, we're already in a culture, we already have language, our brain has already been modified by our cultural experience and personal experience when we're kids. But then when we start to realize that, then we realize, well, we can do practices. We're not talking about technologies now, but we can do practices that will begin to change our own experience, whether these are, moral practices of treating everyone as if they're a Buddha, or whether it's certain kinds of prayers. And you look at the history of religious practitioners, and it's full of techniques for transformation. There's a German philosopher, Peter Sloterdijk, he uses the word anthropotechnics. And what he means by that are like processes that human beings engage with in order to transform their own subjectivity. And what I like about this, and it really relates to what you're doing in the book, is that while there are these important distinctions between external technologies or digital technologies and the psychobiological processes we're already, embedded within, there is this sort of spectrum of like things we do to ourselves to change the way we actually perceive and experience the world. And I agree. It goes really far, far back.
Right. Absolutely. I agree. I think meditation or prayer could be, thought of as ways of changing your perception because they direct your attention to certain things and away from certain other things. And if you want to go even more broadly, you could think of education as another one of those transformative processes. It changes what you think, so it changes how you experience the world. I know other people have made the point that literacy does, having a written word, kind of changes how you perceive things. And I think even more broadly, you could say things like medicine might count. There are other things that we do that shift our perceptual experiences in our bodies that we don't consider unusual or cyborg technologies, but they're really quite profound. So, for example, if you've ever just taken a painkiller not to have a headache, well, now there's a perceptual experience that you're not having or that's different to you. And I think the question of what is medicine and what is biohacking or a cyborg technology, it's really hard for me to answer. I don't know that there's a clear, bright dividing line between the two of those. Well, and some people might even say, for example, if you wear eyeglasses or contact lenses, you have changed your visual perception. And it's in a way that seems very ordinary and acceptable to you now, but it's actually quite profound.
Yeah, no, I agree. And even just take that, I think the question of medicine is really interesting because, one way of looking what's happening when you're taking, at some point you take a compound, you take acetaminophen, and it's going to strike your nervous system in a certain way. I mean, it's going to create its effects because at some point it gets translated into the brain as a pattern of electromagnetic signals. And so it's quite easy to imagine, electrical forms of compounds. And then once you get to that point, which you talk about also in your book, once you get to the point where you're creating perception by directly stimulating the nervous system or the brain, then, all of these category distinctions become even more blurry.
Absolutely. We're really used to the idea that you can kind of chemically stimulate your brain. The idea of electronically stimulating your brain, that's novel, right? But the base is we have always, as humans, changed what's going on in our brain. We're not born knowing and feeling all of the stuff that we do. We kind of rewrite ourselves every day, and that is really fantastic to think about.
Well, and that also kind of raises a really interesting problem about how to tell the story, because I've been around this stuff for a forever, you know, whatever, since the early 90s, I've been tracking kind of transhumanism and all this kind of stuff and up and down. And now as I've been, you know, seeing how much the world's changed and with a lot of the political issues and issues around surveillance and issues around power and seeing what capitalism does to people. And, you know, just the whole range of complexities that we're in now. On the one hand, there is this sort of story of like the biohackers you talk about, these people who are actually putting, you know, technologies inside their bodies themselves and sort of really out there on the edge winging it. And there's this kind of, creative heroism there that I really respond to. I love that kind of stuff. I love people pushing the boundaries on themselves. But then there's this sort of issue of the way in which as these technologies and as these skills and as these perceptions become integrated into the larger world that is so networked and so fast and changing so rapidly that, you know, all of these unintended things happen, and so that there's a lot of room for concern. And you talk at some point, and I really appreciate you did talk to Adam Wood of Stop the Cyborgs and some other folks who are critical of this. And usually these people are critical not because they think there's anything wrong about an individual putting a RFID tag in their finger. I mean, some, you know, true Neoluddites might think that's disgusting. For me, it's like, whatever. It's just, you know, body mod. You know, get used to it. Read some sci-fi. But the issues come in. The issues come in with how these things get translated into a larger social story. And that's tough. That's a kind of challenge for a reporter, too. You're just trying to get a hold of the science. You're trying to make sure you get the science right and, you know, tell the stories of these of people in labs and working on this stuff. And on the one hand, yes, human beings have always modified their consciousness. And here we go. We're going to use new tools, da-da-da. But there's also this much larger, murkier, spookier thing going on. And how did you sort of navigate that as a journalist?
This is a great question. I really think one of the biggest biases in science reporting or tech reporting is to only talk to people who are pro engineering. You know, only talk to people who think science is always good, and any problem we fall into, we can engineer our way out of it with more science. And I didn't want to just go to extremes between people who say no technology ever and people who say, you know, hooray, let's get to the future as fast as we can. I think there are a lot of voices in the middle who say, look, we have to think about what we want out of this technology, who makes this technology, who owns the data that it collects, and all of these very kind of subtle, sophisticated questions that lie between yes and no. So just to give people an idea of some of the technologies we're talking about in this book, it kind of broke down into two big camps. So one big camp was the group that is usually major universities, research institutions, sometimes military institutions, and sometimes for-profit companies that are working on assistive technologies for people with medical needs. So some of the things I'm talking about are retinal implants that return some degree of vision to people who have almost complete loss of their vision. I am talking about developing neuroprosthetic limbs. So these would be robotic arms and legs that somebody who has either had an amputation or who is paralyzed by stroke or by something like Lou Gehrig's disease, they could have this device that they would move with the power of thought, and that mechanical arm or mechanical leg would have real-time touch feedback so they could tell what they were touching. They could tell how tightly they were gripping a cup. They could feel the warmth of a loved one's hand, right? We're talking about the development of what's called a brain-machine interface, which means it would be very likely a chip that somebody has implanted in their brain that is able to read out verbal commands, either to allow them to control a device like I was just talking about, or to talk aloud for them. You can imagine how helpful that might be for somebody who's paralyzed and can't speak, somebody who has locked-in syndrome, or some other condition where they can form thoughts, verbal thoughts in their head, but they can't speak aloud. It would allow them to drive a cursor so that they could, convey information to a computer screen without typing. So enormous enormous progress for communications devices and movement devices for people who have a really serious medical disorder. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have not only just biohackers, but people kind of in the entertainment industry, the gaming industry, the virtual reality industry, who are working on products that are sometimes for entertainment, sometimes for self-enhancement, sometimes for health, and sometimes just for the exploring what they're curious about. I use the term psychonauts in this book because I really think some of the biohackers I met are just this generation psychonauts. They want to see what else can my mind explore. And these are people who are doing things like putting those magnets in their bodies in a bid to see if they can have some kind of electromagnetic sensation. They are doing things like putting RFID chips in their bodies because you can use an RFID chip to start your computer, open a door. I met a guy who uses it to turn on his motorcycle. They're talking about, now these don't exist yet, but they're talking about what if we could have devices that would allow us to sense further into the electromagnetic spectrum. Instead of just visible light, what if we could see infrared and ultraviolet and gamma rays? We could pick up radio waves. We could see all of these things that right now we can only sense with a machine or that some other animals can sense that we can't. So like, for example, sharks can sense electricity, but people can't. And butterflies and sea turtles and some kinds of fish, a lot of birds can sense electromagnetic spectrum. So that helps them migrate. And there are animals like the pit viper that can sense into the infrared. So a lot of people are saying, hey, why can't we do this? And wouldn't it be cool? Wouldn't it enhance my life? Wouldn't it expand, kind of that movie in my mind if I had new senses or better senses, right? So, all right, now here's where we get to the question about what could go wrong. Well, a lot could go wrong. And so I went out to talk with people like Stop the Cyborgs, the group you mentioned. I went to talk with the Electronic Frontiers Foundation based here in San Francisco because they are a great civil liberties watchdog group for what happens when people start conveying a lot of information about themselves electronically. I went to talk to a disability scholar because I wanted to know about, well, what problems might arise when you start putting technology on the body? How does that change our expectations of what a normal body is and what a person should be able to do in order to be seen as productive, in order to have a middle-class job, in order to get an education? And these were interesting questions. And so like you, I have a lot of concerns about surveillance and tracking. If we get to the point where everybody's wearing augmented reality glasses or watches or rings or clothing or whatever it is, some kind of sensor, and those devices are tracking your location. Maybe they're taking out some biometrics that have to do with what's going on in your body, your heart rate, that sort of thing. I can see how that might be problematic. Where does that data go? Who owns it? How much control do you have over it? Could it leak, right? And the folks at EFF, when I talked to them, they made a very good point, which is most of us are already doing that. We're doing that with our cell phone. You know, that cell phone ports so much information about your location, your online behavior, the voice content of your phone calls. A lot of people now use them kind of as health devices because you can use them sort of as fitness trackers. A lot of other people wear health wristbands that do things like track your sleep, track the number of steps you've taken, track your, you know, how much activity you've gotten that day. So we're already collecting a lot of this data, and a lot of people don't seem to be super sensitive about it yet. And I thought that was an interesting point. Adam Wood from Stop the Cyborgs also raised a really profound point, which is the idea of networking the devices that are on your body with devices that are on everybody else's body. And I think you could look at this a couple of ways. You could say, oh, everybody's connected, and we could have this kind of new experience of communicating in real time with all of these other people. But he said, yeah, you also get to kind of a Borg, right? You could get to a state where everybody's influencing you in very subtle ways that you might not consciously perceive. And you could have kind of the group start to influence your behavior. So one of the examples that he gave me was, let's say you're walking down the street, you're wearing your augmented reality glasses, I happened to meet him in a pub. So he said, let's say you're walking down the street and you're looking for a pub and you ask your glasses, give me a list of pubs that's in here, that's in the neighborhood. Well, there is some algorithm or some person that's curated that list that it's going to show you. And you don't know what the data is based on. You don't know if it was like, Yelp likes or Facebook scores or who paid the company the most money to get higher in the rankings. And he says you don't know what's left out and you don't know their reasons for choosing what's on that list. If this pub wasn't on the list, you might walk right by it and you would never know. And your behavior would have been subtly altered by the group. And I said, okay, yeah, I see how that could be a problem. I mean, we're already doing that on our phones and on our computers with all of these other kind of ratings and ranking services. I'm not sure that it's any more dangerous than what we already have. And he said, okay, I'll give you another example. What happens if you walk into a store, like a clothing store, and the clerk is wearing augmented reality glasses? And when you walk in, it recognizes who you are and serves that clerk a lot of information about you that changes how they treat you as a customer. Maybe it serves them your credit rating. Maybe it serves them a list of what you've bought in the store or not. Maybe it tells them whether or not you've ever called their 1-800 helpline and yelled at it. Now something different happens. Now you get people's behavior towards you changes, not based on your individual interaction with them, but information they're getting through this device that you can't control. He said, what if the information that people get about you comes from people who dislike you? There was, at the time that I talked to him, some people had created an app where you rated your ex-boyfriend, right? And so I thought, oh man, what if it's your exes out there who are giving the information? What if it's people on Facebook who are saying thumbs or thumbs down, you know, this person is friendly, this person is trustworthy. Okay, now we're getting into some really, I think, kind of queasy making territory. So all of those things gave me some really good things to stew on and made me cautious about how I use the technology I do use today and what I would actually want to put on my body in the future.
Yeah, I know, and I like the way you wove those in. And one of the things that makes me I was very encouraged by your approach is that you spend a lot of time paying attention to the problem of language, partly mm-hmm. because that's one of the problems that you encounter or one of the issues that you encounter in some really direct ways in a couple of your chapters. Just to touch briefly, one, there's this whole question of taste and what are fundamental tastes and whether there are more and whether we can recognize them and how we would describe them. And you talk about the way that umami is now recognized as a taste. I know what it means. I can taste it. I've got that. But that was something that was made part of the science of taste not that long ago. And now people are looking for this other taste or a kind of sounds more like a taste effector called kokumi. And so that's, you know, very interesting about how do we have the ability to have perceptions if we don't have the language for the perception? And it's a chicken and egg problem, which comes first. But it's also a chicken and egg problem about how you talk about this stuff. Is it Is it really augmentation? Is it really enhancement? Well, this sounds pretty good. That just sounds like a plus. Augmentation is a little bit more, has a little more shadow in it, but enhancement's pretty thumbs up. But then you're like, if the enhancement also comes with all of these other kinds of costs or conditions, as we'll put it. Well, then maybe enhanced, maybe mutation is still maybe the better word. You know, our even the language we talk about these things, even if we're being critical or being, you know, open to the range of problems that they raise. Even then, some of the language is itself already kind of hijacked in this soft biohacking way.
This is the chapter that opens the book, and it's about taste. So it's about food, and the technology here is not an electronic technology. It is not something that lights up. The technology is language. And a lot of people don't think of language as a technology, but I think it is. It's something that was invented by people. You are not born with it. You have to acquire it. It's a tool, right? And as a tool, it shapes your perception. It shapes what happens in your mind. So I'm so glad you said that you're an umami taster, because sometimes people think, oh, what is this thing? And I think it has to do, honestly, with when you went to school. So when you and I were going to elementary school, I bet they taught you that there were only four tastes. There were salty, sweet, sour and bitter, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're about the same age.
Yeah, exactly. So back in the day, there were only four tastes. And by the way, they used to teach us that map of the tongue, and they'd say, like, you taste sweet on the tip of your tongue. That's totally bogus. Your taste receptors are distributed all over your mouth, or all over your tongue. But basically, what's going on is, the receptors on your tongue are having a chemical interaction with the foods that you eat. So when you eat sugar, that sugar molecule is locking into that receptor, and the receptor is signaling electrochemically to your brain, sweet, right? And when you eat something that is bitter, the same thing is happening. The receptors for bitter are saying to your brain, hey, we touched something bitter. And interestingly, there are now 25 different kinds of bitter receptors have been found on the tongue. So bitter is not just one thing. It might be many things. And the same thing with more or less with salty, and the salt is a little complicated, but the same idea. There's a chemical reaction that's happening, and it's getting transformed into this electrical signal for the brain. Well, 100 years ago in Japan, in 1908, a chemist named Dr. Kukunai Akita came up with this idea for a fifth taste that he called umami. It literally translates to beautiful taste in Japanese. In English, we say that it means savory, right? And this is kind of the taste that is associated with the chemical is monosodium, or it's the amino acid glutamate, which we know from MSG, monosodium glutamate. And it is very characteristic in certain Japanese foods. It's a characteristic of a broth called dashi, which is kind of the cooking base for a lot of Japanese foods. And in America, this might be the taste that most people would associate with things like a long stewed tomato sauce, caramelized onions, Parmesan cheese, charred meat, all of these things that are very, very savory and contain a lot of glutamate. Well, when he and the Japanese food company, Ajinomoto, that began to produce MSG the following year, started to talk about this idea, when they tried to talk to the Western world, people said, yeah, we don't get it. This is not a thing that we taste. We don't know what you're talking about. It wasn't until the turn of this last century, 2000 and 2002, two different groups found receptors for glutamate on the tongue. So they said, yep, there's a chemical reaction that's happening. You eat these foods, a signal gets sent to your brain that says savory. And that's when the Western world adapted to this idea of umami. And now, in some places, umami is kind of a fetish. You know, certain chefs love to cook in a way that enhances the umami quality of foods. There's a hamburger chain called Umami Burger here in Oakland where I live. There's a store that sells Japanese barware and cooking goods that's called Umami Mart. It's a thing that a lot of people have learned to savor and appreciate. But there was this kind of 100-year gap between people in Japan saying, yes, this thing exists, and people in the Western world saying, yeah, it does, right? What was the difference? I argue that the difference was language, that in Japan, they had a word for it, and they had a concept for it, and they had a cuisine that highlighted the umami characteristics of food. So everybody who had grown up there for several generations was used to the idea, was used to linking that word and that idea with a food that they ate regularly. It seemed obvious to them. And here in the West, we didn't. Umami was a word that meant nothing to a lot of people. So once umami became the fifth accepted taste, it's kind of set off this race, like this quest among people in the food industry and the scientific community to see if there might be a sixth taste or a seventh taste or a thousandth taste, right? So for the first chapter of my book, what I did was I kind of went on a quest myself to taste as many of these contenders as I could. I went to all kinds of different labs. I went to a pickling company. I went to all kinds of food labs. I started at a science museum in Denver. The Denver Museum of Nature and Science is doing this huge citizen science public experiment to see whether fat might be the sixth taste. And the argument for that is your body needs fat. It should have a way of sensing that in your food supply, and that they believe they can prove that fat taste is separate from the mouthfeel, the pleasant kind of creamy sensation that you get in your mouth when you eat ice cream or butter or gravy or something else that has a lot of fat in it. So I went to taste fat. I went to taste calcium, which is another contender. There are some groups that argue that water is one, that carbon dioxide is one, separate from the feeling of carbonation bubbles, but carbonation itself is. There is some pretty interesting evidence that rats and mice can taste three different kinds of sweet, whereas humans can only taste one, that they can basically discern between really long starch chains and medium-sized ones and small ones. So I ate some rat food to see if I could taste it. There's this kind of man-made chemical thing called polycose that is sometimes given to rats, and rats love it. One of the scientists who gave it to me said, nobody can understand why this man-made thing tastes so nice for a rat. To me, it was like eating ground-up styrofoam. I got nothing off of it. And then there's this concept called kokumi, which you mentioned, which is, interestingly enough, being researched by Ajinomoto, the Japanese food company that started manufacturing MSG and promoted the idea of umami to the world. And so kokumi is really a mind-bender. Nobody has come out so far as to say that it's the sixth taste or the seventh taste. They kind of characterize it more as an effect or a phenomenon. And they say what it is it's a chemical substance that tastes like nothing on its own, but it enhances the other basic tastes and makes other basics taste better. So it makes salt saltier. It makes sweet sweeter. It makes savory savorier. And a lot of the people who are researching this are looking at it as maybe something that could be added to food for people who have to monitor their sodium. So things would taste saltier without them eating a lot of salt. Or they're looking at it as a way to kind of enhance kind of that long simmered savory quality of foods. Maybe it's like an additive you could put in to make things feel more savory, feel like they've been cooked a long time, even if they haven't. It's a really wild concept.
Yeah, one of the things I thought you might have brought up that is a really concrete example of this sort of loop between language and taste without bringing on the question of new taste that we can describe in and isolate in scientific sense in a laboratory by showing that there's a certain new receptor and it's doing something new. You can just take the example of like how we learn to drink wine. And you know, if you're a naive wine drinker and you go to like a fancy wine drinking, you know, tasting event, you're like, what? Blackberry, terroir, what the heck? What are you guys talking about? Leathery shoe? I don't want to drink a shoe. You know, and it's just absurd. It's just like absolutely absurd. And you also can't really distinguish what they're talking about. But all of those dimensions are there. And they are there sort of formally. I mean, in the sense that people who are good at it can agree mostly, but not entirely. It's slippery. And so to become someone who appreciates wine, you're not just teaching your taste buds, you're installing these more complex loops between language and taste buds and a social environment where you're with some guy who's going, yes, do you taste the barnyard? You know, you're like, okay, I do. And then, you know, and they isolate the different flavors or whatever. So it's just amazing to me, even not even looking at the technology or the science, and acknowledging full well that we are limited in these ways that frustrate biohackers and they want to like, you know, ramp it up, that there still is so much plasticity even in our ordinary daily lives in terms of how the brain organizes our perception. It's so plastic already, you know, even yes, without all of this technology. And so the technology vastly expands this whole question.
Yeah, and oh man, you put your finger right on it. One of the weird things for taste researchers is that our language doesn't have a lot of great words for taste. We have very few words, and most of the time we default to metaphor, exactly like you were doing. So with wine tasting, people are saying barnyard and blackberry and all of these things that actually signal something else, but they're the closest we can get. So what do we do when your language doesn't have a word for the experience? Well, you probably ignore it, or you probably default to its nearest neighbor for which you do have a word. So for example, for both fat and calcium, in these studies where people taste them, a lot of the times people will use words like bitter or sour. Well, those are already basic tastes, right? But the researchers who are doing this say it's not because these things aren't discrete. They're not different, right? It's not because you couldn't learn to tell them apart. It's because you're kind of looking at the nearest neighbor that you have a word for. And I'll give you a quick example. People always talk about vision research and color. They always say there are some languages that do not have separate words for blue and green. So if you showed a rainbow to somebody from that culture, their eye would be working the same way your eye is. They would be seeing the exact same thing that you're seeing. They would take in the same wavelengths that you do. But that band on the rainbow that you and I separate into two separate things, blue and green, they would see as one continuous band. They have one word for it, one concept. It's one thing, right? I was speaking with a Russian researcher in the course of this. She said, oh yeah, in the Russian language, we actually have two words for different kinds of blue and we discriminate between them, kind of a brighter blue and a darker blue. And she said, English speakers will just say it as though blue is one thing and we'll think of it as two. So basically what you've done is you've created a perceptual category for these two things. So you default to the nearest one, right? So a person who doesn't have separate word for blue and green is only going to come up with one word. Somebody who has separate words is going to see them as two. Maybe that's the same with something like fat taste. Maybe it's close to bitter, but it's not bitter. But we call it bitter because that's the only word that we have. It's really an interesting conundrum.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting just the fact that that umami is the word, that we didn't actually just replace it with savory. I mean, it's partly because of the history of the term and where it came from and that it was recognized in Japan first. But I also kind of like the way that just by thinking about umami, you have to recognize that there's something that's changed in your language in order to kind of have access to it. And in another, just to stay with the language thing, I love the way that this whole question of taste in language was balanced in another chapter by this wonderful, totally unexpected for me, surprising and wonderful investigation of the relationship between the language that we use to describe emotional hurt, particularly rejection, social rejection or love rejection, and actual physical pain. And that we use all these physical metaphors for this. And then you tell a story about how these guys are like, well, maybe there's a reason that we use all of these physical metaphors to describe emotional pain.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you brought this up because I love this chapter. It was so fun to learn about, right? So basically, there's this big wave going on right now in psychological research that says our physical pain and social pain, so the pain of rejection, the pain of lost love, are they actually the same thing to your brain, right? And all of us have kind of grown up thinking of these two things as separate experiences. And we treat people differently when they say they have physical pain versus social pain, right? With physical pain, we're like, oh, you know, there's blood, there's broken bones, it's an emergency. We gotta deal with this right away. And with social pain, you know, we often encourage people to kind of get over things or move on or, you know, not focus immediately on the hurt. We don't treat it like an emergency. And there are a lot of researchers who say, nope, actually to your brain, they are the same thing. And there's a reason, an evolutionary biological reason for why that should be the case. They say physical pain is a warning to your body that says, hey, stop, you're doing something dangerous. You're doing something that's harming you. Stop it. You know, cut it out. And so, you know, you're touching something sharp, you're touching a hot stove, right? And they say social pain is actually the same way. Humans are a pack animal. We have a long childhood. We depend on others for our survival. And if we are being socially rejected, it's because we're doing something that is damaging our ties to the group and it endangers our survival. So we got to cut it out, right? So the way that they have tested it, this is so interesting. So first what they did is they put a lot of people in an fMRI scanner. So this is a functional magnetic resonance imaging scanner. It basically kind of tracks brain activity by tracking blood flow. They can kind of see which areas of the brain are lighting up when you give a person a certain stimulus. So they have people lie in the scanner, and then they socially reject them. So the first generation of experimenters basically showed people pictures of somebody who had recently dumped them, which sounds cruel and unusual, but it worked. They saw that the same centers of the brain that light up for physical pain were lighting up when they saw the picture of their ex. So then they started to do experiments where they said, okay, what if we socially reject people, but we give them the kind of painkiller we usually use for physical pain? In other words, what if we give them acetaminophen, which is better known as Tylenol, right? So what they did was they put people in the scanner and they had them play this game they called Cyberball. And they told people that it was kind of like it's based on the idea of Frisbee or something like that. So they said, you're going to be passing a ball back and forth with other players. Well, the subjects didn't know that there weren't really other players. It was a computer program that was programmed to pass them the ball a few times and then leave them out of the game. And even with this very, very subtle rejection, people felt hurt. The pain centers of their brain lit up. But people in the study who had been taking a course of acetaminophen, the generic for Tylenol, felt less rejection. So taking a physical painkiller dulled social pain. So then different experimenters said, okay, let's do this thing in reverse. Let's see if you can give people physical pain and if love can work as a painkiller. So they did things where they would put people in the scanner again, and they would show them either the picture of their romantic partner or a picture of an equally attractive stranger or a picture of an inanimate object like a chair. And then they would deliver them, like a small burn on their arm. They use this kind of electrode wand for experiments like these that develops that it creates a burn that kind of feels like a sting. And they find, yes, people who are looking at the picture of the person they're in love with feel less pain. They actually literally report feeling less pain. So love is actually a painkiller. So this is kind of this fascinating line of work. And for a lot of people, it said it's really changed our minds about how we should be thinking about things like bullying in schools, how we should think about social rejection on the playground where kids won't let other kids play with them. It changes how we should think about somebody who's having trouble getting over a breakup because they are literally experiencing pain, the kind of pain we usually associate with blood, and we shouldn't be writing it off for them. And just like with food, you are so right, it's kind of a category sorting problem, right? We used to think of these two things as separate, social pain and physical pain. Maybe they're really one thing. Just the way that, you know, some people think of blue and green as separate, and now they think of them as one thing, right? It's the way you conceive of it affects how you pay attention to it and how you react to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the kind of sort of primary school level lessons in being a long-term meditator is being able to, because if certainly if you're like sitting for, you know, all day for days, you're going to get pain. And so you start to recognize that there's a very distinct difference between physical sensation, which we can describe in all sorts of ways. Oh, it's spiky, it's warm, it's whatever, intense. And suffering. Oh, this is pain. Oh, I'm feeling pain and da da da. And you realize that there's like very many layers there, but there's actually a pretty sharp divide. And we can see that with you know, emotional pain as well, in the sense that it's your interpretive part, it's the interpretive part of it that's really raging more than any particular, like, you know, specific location of a sensation in your chest or whatever, but that they're both linked. So you get rejected, you feel a certain way in your chest, and that you felt that way before, and then you're just going to kick in all of those layers of suffering on top of the sensation. So I thought that was just really interesting that people were kind of literalizing the metaphor in a sense, and seeing the way that it actually changes how we frame, you know, such a core part of our experience as emotions.
Right. It's really fascinating. One of the big things that I gained from researching that chapter was learning to think of pain as meaningful rather than kind of a break in a normal healthy state. I was, when I interviewed Dr. Sean Mackey, who's a pain researcher at Stanford, one of the people whose lab has been involved in some of the experiments that I mentioned, I said, why would we evolve something that sucks? You know, like, why would we evolve a way to feel bad? And he said, no, pain is great because it is so bad. Pain is the great protector. And if you didn't have pain, terrible things would happen to your body all of the time. And, you know, kind of by extension, the argument for social pain is terrible things would happen to you as a social person, too, if you couldn't experience rejection. And one of the really interesting things that those researchers were looking into was, why does social pain linger longer than physical pain? You know, some of them told me things like, you know, I had a really bad football accident in high school, where I think the researcher was telling me that he'd cracked a vertebra, and he says it was extraordinarily painful at the time, but I'm not still stewing on it now. But romantic rejections, I do. One of the researchers, Dr. Naomi Eisenberger at UCLA, who's a leader in this field, said she has tried to kind of go back into her body and recreate the worst physical pain of her life, which was the experience of childbirth, and she says, I can't do it. But if I sit here and I think about somebody from high school who dumped me, I can instantly go back to that pain. And I thought that was very a very interesting maybe difference between these two, which is that physical pain you kind of think about in the moment that you're getting that signal from the sensors that are called nociceptors that something's wrong, right? Emotional pain tends to last because we can recreate it in our minds without that physical sensation. So you can kind of stew on it. And one of the things that they found with the fMRI scanner is part of the brain that is lighting up when people think about social pain, social rejection, is the part of the brain that processes not what you are feeling physically, but the idea of what other people are thinking of you. It's the part of your brain that's involved in interpreting others and how others see you. So it's a really interesting little kink right there.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it loops back to the whole soft biohacking idea that part of what makes our emotional pain sustain itself, perhaps, and we're speculating here, but perhaps is that it's not just your individual pain, but that you recognize that you are a social being who's being perceived by others. And if you've been rejected, then everybody kind of recognizes the rejection. So it's not just your own experience of rejection. It's your recognition that all these other people have that perception of you. And maybe that's partly also what drives it.
And this is not just with pain, but with so many other perceptions. Part of it has to do with the idea of being a social animal who lives in a group. So you need words to express what you're experiencing. So, you need the understanding of other people. Other people need to be able to treat you appropriately in response. All of these things, there's kind of layer upon layer of how we build this experience in our brain. And knowing how to communicate our internal state to others and knowing how they're going to react is all part of that series of layers, loops within loops.
Yeah, and sometimes you need a fifth limb coming out of your chest. And that was my favorite of the personal stories that you told, is when you went to this VR lab, I think it was in Stanford, and where they're experimenting with modifying the avatar in ways that extend your skill set, and even with a strong example of having a new limb that your brain has to learn how to kind of operate, and after a while, apparently not very long, you get used to it. So tell a little bit about what they're studying and your experience. We have about six minutes left.
Okay, cool. Well, this chapter was so fun to research. I wanted to learn about VR because, you and your listeners probably know, you know, just a decade or so ago, VR was really clunky. Everything was really pixelated and cartoonish, and it just didn't feel real. But it's really changed a lot. And VR gear is becoming much more immersive, much more lightweight, much more convincing. So I wanted to know, okay, we have as a species transported our consciousness with books, with movies, with music, with daydreaming, with actual literal dreaming, you know, for a long time. What might be the new technological platform for transporting yourself into some alternate life? And when I went to Dr. Jeremy Bailenson's lab at Stanford, he said, let's not just talk about alternate lives. Let's talk about alternate bodies. So he's really inspired by the work of Jaron Lanier, who is often called the godfather of virtual reality. One of the questions that Lanier had posed a long time ago was, okay, why in cyberspace, why do you have to be another human? You could be anything at all. And he said, what if you were a lobster? A lobster has 8 arms. Okay, so you learn to control arm 1 by moving one of your arms, and you learn to control arm 2 by moving the other arm. How do you learn to control arms 3 through 8? And so Jeremy Bailenson's lab has been tackling this in some really interesting ways, working with alternative bodies. So one of the things that they did was they gave me a third arm, and they wanted to see how quickly I could adapt to it. So this arm, kind of in the virtual world, protruded out of my chest, right? There's nothing, I'm not wearing anything special in the real world. This is just, it's totally happening in the virtual world. So it sticks out of my chest. And on my real world arms, I am wearing kind of like a tracking, an infrared tracking device on each wrist. And they don't give me any training on how I'm supposed to control this third arm. They just throw me into the simulation and they say, learn to use it. And then they give me my task. And my task is, there's all of these boxes that appear to be floating in space in front of me. And the boxes on my right are close enough that I can reach out and touch them with my real right arm. And the boxes on my left, I can touch with my real left arm. But the boxes that are straight ahead of me are far enough away that I can only get to them if I learn how to control this third arm. And I start to think, man, this is going to be really hard. How am I going to do this? Well, it just instantly happens. Somehow I move my right arm and my left arm and it moves the third arm to the right place, and boom, I tap that box. And it happens over and over again. It is so natural and so intuitive that I love it. I just enjoy it so much. I start to think, oh man, I hope in the future this is a real job skill. I can control virtual limbs. Then they said, we're going to do one more test. And so all of the boxes go away, and all of a sudden there's this big bullseye hanging in front of me. And they say, reach out and touch the bullseye with your third arm. So I do. And then all of a sudden, there's this huge flash of light. And my brain instantly registers this as, my arm is on fire. And my real world body flinches. I feel myself kind of just jump back and go into a cringe. And that's what they wanted to test. They wanted to test whether or not you would feel that that limb was yours, and that if it was threatened, that you were in danger. So I think what that test is showing is that in virtual worlds, we can feel very real. We can react as though those bodies are really our bodies.
Yeah, and here we go. Boy, is it going to be wacky. Having been there, been around in the early, you know, that first wave, and, you know, being a part of those conferences and conversations and everything, it's really remarkable to sort of loop around. It's a little bit surreal, frankly. But I just wanted to make one point. We got to wrap it up here. Is that what's funny is that when I read your book, I thought I was going to, you know, and I did learn a lot about new technologies and new processes in the lab and ways of enhancing perception and gear and electromagnetism, et cetera, et cetera. But it was equally about neuroplasticity and really what that really means for us all to really reconcile on an everyday level and a big picture level with the who we think we are, that our brains are so adaptable in some ways and so open to new experiences. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has been, it was a pleasure to research, and it's really been a pleasure to talk to you today. Thank you for taking the time to read it and for all these great questions.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us in Expanding Mind.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks, Eric.
Okay. So for all you out there, next week we'll be talking with Stephen Hill of Hearts of Space. So until then, keep your minds open.